My dad was actually a professional baseball player. As soon as spring break came around, he was gone. That additional time with the kids was just a light switch in their lives. They loved it. They loved it that I can be home with them all summer, just like they were, that all my breaks lined up with theirs, that I was seeing them in the hallways. That was just, they were filled with so much more joy and energy.
My name is Tim Anderson. Welcome to Father and Friend, where men learn to live for the good of their families.
Today, we're with Michael Hernandez. He is a Catholic husband and father of four from Texas. He's a coach, and he's the author of the book, Before You Go, Life Advice for the Rising Generation. He's the father of four, and we're going to find out how Michael is impacting his family for good. I hope you enjoy. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So why don't we just start by telling me a little bit about your upbringing. What was your father like? What was your upbringing like?
So I came from a very fortunate circumstance where, you know, I had a father and mother in the house. My dad was actually a professional baseball player. So he played in the major leagues. And so when he was there, he was a fully engaged dad. He'd be playing with us, taking us to the ballpark. He'd be reading books to us, telling stories, laughing with us. The hardest part was actually during the season. As soon as spring break came around, he was gone, and he'd be gone for, you know, 6 to 8 months out of the year. We wouldn't really see him again actively that much until, you know, maybe about November, assuming they didn't make the playoffs.
What position was he?
He was a pitcher. He was a relief pitcher. He played for the Astros, Yankees, Rangers, Reds, and Blue Jays. So he was all over the place. And wow. I remember traveling a lot. That's what a lot of my early childhood memories are. I was born into it. So he was playing before I was born, when my older sister was born. By the time I came around, he was well into his career. And so I was just born into that mode of traveling to New York and traveling to California and traveling to Toronto. And the earliest homes I remember being in was like a temporary home in Arlington when he played for the Texas Rangers. So an early childhood memory for me was a sense of joy when he was around, but this sense of real sadness when we had to leave. That was a constant theme in life. There'd be this joy of seeing him, getting to go see him wherever he was at. When the school year ended, we'd get to go take a road trip and follow him wherever he was at. But there was always the end of summer when we'd have to go back and we'd leave, and that was always a real emotional thing. So it was kind of this moments of joy and then moments of sadness, and it all had to do with just whether or not he was able to be there. Because while he was there, while he was with us, it was wonderful. I have a great dad. I really do. Mm.
So I'm not actually a baseball fan. How long is the season that he's gone for?
So usually the pitchers and catchers report to spring training that marks kind of the beginning of the season in March. So that's usually when it starts. And from that point on, you're in it. If you don't live where your team is, then you're away from home from March all the way until the season ends in September, unless your team makes the playoffs, in which case that's when you have October baseball. Because the season can change and schedules change, sometimes you might play all the way into November. So that's a long 162 games split up by an all-star break and then a couple days off mixed in. It's a long haul.
Wow. So he could be gone upwards of 9 months.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a really long time.
Yeah. And when his career as a Major League Baseball player ended, he took about a year off when he was kind of figuring out what to do. He finished his degree at Houston Baptist University. And after that, he got a job in minor league baseball in the Tampa Bay Rays organization. So that began another 9-year cycle where he was gone for the whole season and would come back. And most of my formative years in childhood actually don't come from him playing. They come from him coaching. So while he was coaching all these teams, those are the years I really remember, because when we'd go up and see him during the summer, my younger three siblings would stay with my mom at the apartment nearby the stadium, and then I would get to go with dad to the ballpark. And he would let me join on as like the bat boy who'd go get the bats after the player gets a hit, go bring the baseballs to the umpire. And so like I had a job, he gave me a job to do, work to actually feel like I was accomplishing something. He'd pay me out of his own pocket, make it feel like a real job experience. And I got to meet some, you know, great players. Some of them went on to actually really cool baseball careers. But the fun part was just being on the road with dad, getting to go to all these different cities, stay in all these different hotels, meet all these different people, and just being with dad constantly. And it was one of those things where my siblings didn't exactly get that, because they would stay home. I'd get to go with dad. And so I actually had this very unique experience from my siblings.
Mm. Now, was that time where you were with your dad, that was when you went to visit him, but were you in a school where your permanent house was, or did you move around with dad?
No, we lived in Houston, the Houston area, all my life. And then dad was working for years. It was in North Carolina or South Carolina. And then it was Montgomery, Alabama. And then it was Durham, North Carolina. So we'd only get to see him during the summer. We might go see him every now and then during spring training. We'd have a week off for school for spring break, and we'd go up and visit him while he was in Florida. And then we'd come back, finish our school year. And then when the school year ended, we'd drive up as a family to South Carolina or North Carolina or Alabama, where he was at. Wow. So that'd give us a solid, you know, month and a half, 2 months to be with dad before we'd have to go back to and begin school. He would finish out his season and be back usually around September, October.
So would you say for most of the year then you would have been raised by your mom?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And, you know, mom held down a house with three insane kids. I mean, we were all over the place, and mom did her absolute best. And the one thing I appreciate most from mom is that she made sure that we were going to church every Sunday, like without question. And we fought her tooth and nail over it too. We were just, you know, rambunctious kids that just didn't want to sit down and go to church. We didn't want anything to do with it. And so she would just put her foot down. Like, no matter what, we have sports, great, we'll find a church to go in that city. When we went out of town to go be with dad, all right, the first thing she would look up on MapQuest. They didn't have, you know, the iPhones back then. She'd look it up online with MapQuest. Okay, let's find one of the nearest Catholic churches. All right, we'll go there. And that was one thing I appreciate the most out of mom. She made us go to Mass no matter what.
Mm. That's good. So you mentioned that you have a great dad. You remember he obviously worked hard. What are three things from your dad that you've kept that you continue to do with your own family?
Number one is having a meal together. So despite the fact that dad was always away, when we were able to be together as a family, dad absolutely insisted we had at least one meal together, despite the fact that he might have to run to the ballpark or me and him might not get back from the baseball field until almost midnight. You know, we'd find some way to be together as a family, to commune with each other, and to have a meal, whether that was breakfast, lunch, or dinner. That was really important to him, and he got that from his own parents. And that's something I've taken with me today. Despite how hectic our schedule may be with my wife and I and with our kids and their sports and school, we guarantee no matter what, hands down, we're going to sit down at that table and have one meal together at least. That'd be number one, having a meal together. Number two would be dad always insisted on spending time with us outdoors. He didn't really consider time with us to be sitting down watching a movie or sitting down playing video games. We do that as a family from time to time. We'd go out to the movies or sit down and watch a comedy show or something. But he always wanted us to go outside, to go to the park, to go to the playground, to throw a baseball outside, or to go hiking, or to take us hunting during the hunting season. He was definitely someone that he still is. He's someone that loves being outdoors, and he wanted to share that with us. So we were always outside with us. And I to this day, I still love being outside with the kids. I love bringing them to parks and playgrounds more than I like taking them to, you know, the movies or like laser tag indoor things. I kind of have an aversion to it almost, unless it's a bookstore. I don't know why I love reading, but I just love being outside with them. I want my kids to experience grass under their feet, the sun on their face, and it's, they've really taken a shine to it as well. And then I think finally the third thing would be probably be ensuring that his children were disciplined. I think a hard part about being a dad that's not always able to be present, having to travel a lot for work, is when you're home, you never want to be the bad guy. There, you know, and I experienced it a little bit as well. I worked in sales where I wasn't really home. I'd be gone for pretty long stints. And so when you come home, the last thing you want to have to do is correct your children's misbehavior, and they have to be the authoritarian in the household. But dad was always quick to fulfill that role, to be the authoritarian in the house. If he came home after being gone, of course he's filled with joy. He finally gets to see his kids after months. But if, you know, he gets the rundown from mom, hey, they've been really struggling with X, Y, and Z, he would address that first. Mm-hmm. You know, hugs and kisses. All right, let's address this bad behavior, whatever it is, and then go right back to having a joy-filled house. So yeah, he still fulfills his role as the authoritarian of the house.
That's great. Can you give me an example, a memory you have of him doing that? Because I imagine that must be really difficult. Even when I've been away for short periods of time, and then I come back, it feels challenging to start off as, let's correct these things that happened, versus I'm just glad to be here and see you guys, you know?
Yeah. One of the clear memories I have from high school was he was gone coaching. And this whole year, I had just been a burr in my mom's side about everything. I mean, I was just filled with teenage angst. I was just being a pill about everything. And dad's...
What kinds of things would you say to your mom? Was it going to church? You're like, I don't want to go.
Going to church, then... after church, we had what was called Life Night, where the teens would get ready for confirmation. And so we were supposed to be going to these meetings where we discuss our faith, do Bible study. And I was actually attending some of the time, but I'd actually try and skip. And mom found out that I was skipping that as well. I was giving
like
my mom-
you would tell her you were going to go, but then you would leave like before the class started.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just that. And it was terrible behavior. And then in the way I interacted with my mom, it was just disrespectful, back talking. I mean, there were times where I even would just explode in anger, just start cursing my own mom out. It was just horrible behavior. Mm-hmm. And my dad would constantly get updates like this on the phone. And I could tell it was just breaking my mom's heart. It was infuriating to my dad, who wanted to be able to help, but couldn't. He was literally entire states away. Mm-hmm. So we'd have conversations on the phone, mixed in with game reports on how I was doing in my own baseball season for school. But he came home after one of these seasons, and a couple days before that, I'd had a really bad, you know, knockdown, drag out, screaming match with my mom. And he gets home, he gives everyone a big hug, holds him tight, gives him kisses, does the same for me. And then as everyone goes into the house, he says, son, follow me. And we go into the study, which was his place to talk. So if you're getting called to the study, you did something wrong, whether it was your grades or what. And he sat down in his chair, leaned back. I still have the chair today, actually. Leans back in his chair and just gives me a rundown of everything I'd been doing wrong, letting my grades slip, missing tutorials. I think I skipped a practice at one point just to hang out with friends, which was stupid. And then the really bad stuff, just missing church, skipping out of the confirmation classes. And then he goes over the argument I had with my mom. Mm. And he just really tears me a new one, just talking about how irresponsible it is and how I have obligations that I'm going to have to fulfill as a man when I get older. And I'll understand one day just how detrimental this was to the family. And his big emphasis in this whole conversation, as he's just chewing me out, is the toll it's taking on my mother and the toll it's taking on the family. Mm. It wasn't from his angle how mad he is or how it makes him look bad or whatever. It was all about the family to him, what it was doing to his wife, what it was doing to the family. And so that really hit home. But after that conversation, and I took it like any teenager would, like despite how I felt inside, I was just this moody teenager, okay, you know, not giving an answer. But afterwards, he gives me a hug, gives me a kiss, and then starts asking me how my recent game was for high school. And so we talked baseball, went over my mechanics as a pitcher, and it was water under the bridge. So that would have been an easy moment. What the easy thing to do as a father would have been to kind of gloss over it and just, hey, let's go out and do something fun. I'm finally home. I've missed y'all guys so much. Let's go out for, you know, to watch a movie. Let's go out and go for a hike. Let's go do this or that. I think it was difficult for him to, on top of all this joy of being home, let me address this really ugly thing that's hurting the family. Mm-hmm. Address it with you directly. So I still appreciate that to this day.
Mm. Do you remember him regularly taking that approach where he would do the correcting, but then there was always kind of we have more of a relationship. Like there's another conversation to have here that's really positive after the correcting.
Yeah, that was constant throughout my whole life and the life of my siblings. If he noticed when he was home, if he noticed us giving attitude to our mother or, you know, fighting amongst each other, he would address it instantly, like right there on the spot, really quick. And you'd see him go from happy, laughing to, hey, you know, turn on the dad voice, address it really quick, and then immediately switch back as soon as it was addressed, as soon as, you know, if we were fighting, if we stopped fighting, if we were giving an attitude to our mother, if we apologized. Now that order's been restored, he'd go back to being the overall joyful dad he's always been. And what's funny is I see that now too with my own kids. So when I bring my kids over to my mom and dad's house and dad's playing with them, he is all smiles, you know, playing with them, laughing with them, joking with them, doing little rhymes and like, you know, patty cake games with my younger siblings. But as soon as one of them starts acting out of line, addresses it on the spot, then reels it back in. It's kind of funny seeing how that habit was never changed.
Yeah. I wonder, I'd be curious if he learned that from his own dad.
I think so. I only really knew my grandfather like in his old age, so I didn't get to see how he handled my dad and my uncles growing up, because they were just as rambunctious as me and my siblings, if not more. You got a house of four boys. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I'm sure they were a handful. And so I never got to see how he handled some of those stickier situations. I only knew him when he was kind of calm, didn't really have too much craziness to deal with. But everything I've heard about him is he was always quick to spend time with his sons, take them hunting, take them fishing, you know, spend real carefree timelessness with his sons. But then he was very quick to, you know, give them an old fashioned whooping or something if they were being crazy, you know.
Out of line.
Yeah, out of line. I mean, that was, when you think about it, that was 60s, 70s parenting. So that was probably a lot more hardcore.
Right. All right. So why don't we talk about, let's transition to some of the things that you're doing that you feel have a positive impact on your family.
Yeah. First thing I do is go to church. I didn't exactly get that from dad. That was more of something I got from mom. I think we talked about it a little bit earlier, but my mom made sure we're always going to church. And when I had a conversation with my dad's mom, she said that the Hernandez men have so many good qualities. They spend time with their children. They're providers. They're protectors. There's so many positive qualities. The one positive quality that will lack is the willingness of Hernandez men to be the spiritual leader of their house. Mm-hmm. And it was something my grandfather struggled with. It was mainly my grandmother that took my dad and uncles to church. And then in our own house, dad was gone most of the time. So it was mom that took us to church. And it was mom that insisted on us actually practicing our faith outside of the church, trying to get us together to pray from time to time. And that was one thing I insisted on when my wife and I began having kids is we'd go to church. And it was something I struggled with in the early years. But exactly, it was something I didn't really have a frame of reference, a North Star from a dad's perspective, what it's like for the dad to say, all right, family, let's go get dressed. We're all going to church. Let's sit down. We're all praying together as a family. Let's do Bible study as a family. I didn't really have that rubric from a fatherhood's perspective. And so it took some getting used to, some adjustment. And over the past probably 5 or 6 years, I've really done a much better job making sure our family doesn't miss a Sunday mass, mm-hmm. making sure our family does pray. And I essentially have a no excuses mentality when it comes to mass. You know, mm-hmm. we can have games. If we have a baseball game, we're going to go to church anyway. If one of us is sick, all right, well, the others are going to mass. This past Sunday, my son was sick, and so my wife stayed home to watch him. The rest of us went to mass. They watched mass online. So the mass is filmed every Saturday. That way, for people in the hospital, for people that are bedridden, they can watch it. So that approach has really helped our family. I think it's brought a lot of peace amongst the family that can be, strife filled from time to time. We're all pretty rambunctious as well, just like me and my siblings were. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is going to church.
What was the step that pushed you to go, this is something I need to do. This is something I need to change that I don't actually have a frame of reference for.
So in the early years of my wife and I being married and having kids, going to church was kind of an optional thing. It was more of a, hey, it's Sunday, should we go to mass today? Do we have time? Do we have this? Do we have that? All right, sure. It was mass church out of convenience. Mm-hmm. So we weren't going to plan our whole day around going to church. And during that time, I know they say correlation doesn't equal causation, but it's a pretty strange coincidence. That was some of the worst years of our marriage and as a family. Like, we really struggled just in the way we related to each other, in the way we spent time together. There's a lot of there was a lack of peace.
Can you describe what that looked like?
Just a lot of family fighting. My wife and I seem to struggle with how to handle, the toddler behavior, how to be authoritative without being authoritarian. Mm-hmm. We really struggle with the parenthood. We really struggle with how to relate to each other when we were disagreeing about a certain thing. And that could have been about the kids or about, where to eat. So something really big versus little things. There just always seemed to be sand in the gears of the marriage and of the parents and kids. Mm. So it was a really tough first few years. Mm. And what's funny is I knew something was wrong, and I knew it had to do with, us as a family. You know, it's not like there were outside forces attacking us. We were struggling internally. And I just couldn't bring myself to find out that going to church was a crucial key in unlocking those difficulties. And right around the time I was ending my career in sales, we got our kids enrolled at a little Catholic school, the same one that I went to as a kid. And ironically, at that same time, they had a job opening for an art teacher. And I happened to get my degree in art. And so I threw my hat in the ring. Well, what if I worked here? It would give me time to spend with my kids, and it would put me back in an environment that I felt was calling me. I couldn't describe why, but I just knew that I needed to be in a different environment. I knew sales wasn't it. As much as I enjoyed that job and the people I worked for, they're great people, it's a family business, but I knew, I felt it in my heart that God was calling me. And so I got the job. I spent the past 4 years working there. And it was through that where I was constantly in the rhythm of faith. So at that school, they go to church every Friday as well. So I was going to church once a week anyway on Fridays, but then it became a built-in habit of, well, we need to go Sunday as well as a family. That's when God calls us to go to church anyway. And so really going back to that environment of faith that I grew up in, that really flicked the light switch for me that, oh my gosh, this is it. And that didn't mean our troubles went away. We still had challenges just like any family, but that became kind of a base, a foundation for our family to build off of, which was Mass every Sunday. And through that, certain things also fell into place. We were spending more time together. Now that we were building our day around church, we also had kind of a designated day where there's really nothing going on. So I didn't make plans. I also give private lessons for baseball. I said, all right, I'll just take those out. I won't do games Saturday or Sunday. And so we have this whole day. We'll just make it a family day. So we were spending more time together as a family, which made it a lot easier for us to work out difficulties because we had time to actually practice it, to work on it. Sunday also became a very common day for my wife and I to have a date night. So that carved out more time for us to work on the marriage, which helped in our relationship to the kids. It was this cascade effect once we started going to church.
But did some of those, like theologically, did some of those things like come back to you and go, oh man, I thought I was good without God?
Yeah. Some of those things did come back, the lessons from my childhood, the curriculum when I was a student at that Catholic school. But another aspect of it that left me no excuse other to not apply it to my own life was every teacher at that school, regardless of whether you were teaching religion class, social studies, math, art, band, science, whatever, you also have to incorporate the faith into the curriculum. And so I was teaching art, which makes it a lot easier because so much of the most beautiful inspired art was done through God, you know, whether that's the work of Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Donatello, all of them did these magnificent, beautiful works that were inspired by faith. And so I found myself talking about art and giving lessons concerning the curriculum, but also infusing it with our shared faith between me and the class. And so we would also have all these theological discussions about the importance of Christ's place in their lives, how it's applicable to their daily life. And I taught middle school, so I was talking to 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And so the way you reach a lot of these age groups is by giving them relatable stories, giving them not just the material of, oh, God loves us. You know, that's a simple phrase. It doesn't mean that much to a kid, you know, who's 13 years old. But when you are able to share how that actually affects them directly, it takes on a whole new meaning for them. So when I'm teaching these kids about our faith, in addition to art, I'm also thinking about it internally, like, okay, this also applies to my life as a father, my wife's life as a mother, as a wife, and our children, you know. And I had this revelation at one point, and I don't know where it came from, but I was writing lesson plans, but as I was typing it up, I had this thought about my own kids, and it was, they're not your children. And I really stopped, and I had to kind of do a double take as I was put my laptop down. I really had to think about that. They're not my kids. My wife and I, you know, helped to create them. We're raising them. We love them, but they're not ours. They're God's children. We're supposed to be stewards that shepherd our children to their rightful father in heaven. And so I don't know why it took so long for that to click, but the whole approach to parenting began to make more sense for me. It was no matter what sacrifices I make for our children, it's not a sacrifice I'm making because I'm such a swell guy. It's no. I need to take care of them. I need to protect them. I need to provide for them. I need to instill in them a knowledge and wisdom of the faith and God's love for them with every fiber of my being so that they can end up back in God's hands in heaven. So yeah, that was a revelatory moment for me.
Man, that's good. Yeah, I love that. It reminds me of that passage, you know, the cattle on a thousand hills belongs to God. And, you know, I guess similarly, you know, the children of a thousand families, they belong to God, you know? That's good. Excellent. All right. So going to church and being committed to making that a priority in your family has had a positive impact on what you're doing. And I guess, you know, maybe going to church is the way that you've made God a priority in your family.
Correct.
That's the means and method for God to be prioritized in your family. Would that be the right way you'd say that, or would you say it some other way?
Yeah, no, that's correct. On top of that, kind of layered on top of the fact that we're going to church every Sunday now, is I wanted to make sure it didn't end with Sunday. It wasn't like, hey, we're going to be good to each other on Sunday, and then, you know, starting Monday, we're back to fighting. We're not applying our faith. And one way I wanted to help keep that going, keep that Sunday energy going, is through daily prayer. So throughout the school week, on the way to school, me and the kids were praying the rosary as we go to school. And what's funny is I'll see a noticeable change in the kids, whether or not they're fully engaged in the prayer, that's neither here nor there. But through the course of praying the rosary, I noticed that when we get into the car, there might be squabbles and fighting, maybe someone's elbowing someone else in the back seat. And I just keep it going. Nope, I'm not going to stop the prayer. We're going to continue. And you know, by the second or third Hail Mary, the squabbling is getting quieter. By the fourth and fifth and sixth, it's quiet. So by the time we finish a decade of the rosary praying together, it's quiet. Everyone's calm. It's got a meditative effect on the family as well. It's really like adding layers of peace over the family. We'll sit down as a family too in the living room. We'll pray from time to time. The one thing I want to add into our family's habits is actually a Bible study. We've tried it a time or two, and each time I just got kind of too lazy with it. I don't know why. Like, I didn't follow up and build it into a habit. But that's one thing I definitely want to incorporate into our family, is sitting together as a family, opening up the Bible, and just diving into God's word. And I think that will supply more fruits to our family, more graces, and you know, more enrichment for our children's hearts and minds.
So you've started praying every day. Is that your second positive, that
yeah,
praying daily?
Not just as with me and the kids, but also when my wife and I go to bed, we'll kind of, one of the last things we do before we just go ahead and turn off the lights and go to sleep is we'll pray together.
So in the morning when you pray, you're driving your kids to school. So yeah. you just get in the car, you start driving. Do you have a conversation first, or is it like, as soon as I press the gas pedal, dude, we're starting?
That's pretty much it. Like we'll pile into the car. If I have to deal with any immediate, you know, craziness, you know, hey, sit down. I told you to buckle up, you know, buckle up, all that. And then as soon as we're pulling into the driveway, you know, we'll have a quick discussion. All right, what do y'all want to, do you want to do the glorious mysteries today or the sorrowful mysteries? We'll focus on a particular set of mysteries from the life and mission of Christ. And, you know, they might give me a refresher. Oh, no, we're on the second glorious mystery today. I'm like, all right, thank you. I forgot it's Tuesday. So then we start that, start with the Our Father, 10 Hail Marys, Glory Be, Fatima prayer. And by that time, it's a pretty quick ride to school. We're just in a completely different mindset.
Do you find that you don't finish by the time you get to school and it just ends, or do you manage to get through the whole sort of what you expected to do?
Well, we always manage to get through the full decade. What's funny is we actually used to live a lot further. So we'd be driving for 40 minutes. And so we'd get through an entire rosary, which is 5 decades. So, you know, you got, you know, 50 Hail Marys, 5 Our Fathers. It's a lot of prayers that we were able to pack in. But since we moved closer, it's, you know, I've had to kind of adjust it. Okay, we're not going to do a full trip around the bases. We'll do 1 decade of the rosary. And then, actually, one thing I'm just realizing it now that I used to do that I need to incorporate again. I don't know why I completely forgot, but before we would start each time, I'd ask each of my kids, like, what do you want to pray for today? What do you want to pray for? And so they might pray for siblings that are sick, other family members. I remember when my uncle passed away, for like the next week, then they were praying for him, praying for his soul. They might pray for friends. It was beautiful. I don't know why. It was just one of those things where maybe I forgot one day and I just kind of compiled into 3, but I'm glad we had this conversation. That reminds me tomorrow, like starting Tuesday, let's bring that back, because that also helped get them into that mindset of prayer of, let me stop thinking about me and what's going on with my day. Let me think about others. Who needs my prayers today? How can I use my voice for someone else's good and to praise God?
That's really good. That's fantastic. So your prayers in the morning are in the car. You jump in the car, you pray through the rosary. And then at nighttime, when you pray with your wife, what does that look like? Do you say, okay, now we're going to pray? You know, help me understand what that conversation looks like. How did you get started doing that?
Yeah. So it was actually my wife's idea. You know, it came at like the strangest moment. So we're sitting in bed and we just went through kind of an argument where I was just upset about something, wasn't handling it in a mature way. And, you know, I was ready to just turn out the light, go to bed, and that was it, not another word. And I can get really hard-headed and stubborn, and, you know, I have plenty of pitfalls in that regard. But my wife kind of pauses, goes, hey, do you want to pray together? And I was like, huh? You know, just kind of still with my hands up, ready to rock and roll in an argument. And she goes, no, do you want to, let's pray together. And I was like, okay, all right, fine. And so I gave her a quick prayer, you know, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, you know, thank you, God, for this day. Thank you for the gift of our family and for our home. And as the prayer was moving forward, I felt myself start to relax more and stop thinking in terms of animosity and my pride and what I think was wrong done to me, and started thinking more of, no, what are the blessings that God has given you in this day? He's given you a wife that loves you, that cares about you, that's devoted to you. He's given you 4 wonderful, healthy children that are filled with joy and happiness, that want to be around their father, that want to play with them. He's given you a roof over your head. He's given you a safe community to live in, a church to go to. Like, I can go on. We can have a whole other podcast with just the blessings God gave me on that particular day. So that really kind of loosened me up, realizing that no matter how angry I am, no matter how bad a day might have been through, you know, one lens, when you put the additional, the real lens on, the lens of truth, okay, what did God actually bless you with today? It's orders of magnitude beyond any difficulties you might have gone through. So it definitely helps ending your day in prayer and making it a prayer of gratitude. That changes your perspective and allows you to go to bed with so much more peace, knowing that God has blessed you.
So the first time your wife extended the request and you're like, fine, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Knowing that it was the right thing to do. And then what does that look like now? Do you just know, hey, we're going to do this? Or do you usually say, hey, do you want to pray now? Like, what does that look like?
It'll change from time to time. So, you know, it might be one of those things where we lay down and, you know, I'm about to turn the lights out and she'll say, hey, did we pray today? Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh, hold on. One more second. You know, we'll go ahead and start praying. There have been other nights where we turn the lights out, you know, we lay down, we're about to fall into sleep, but then I'll just kind of realize it and go and start praying, you know, no lead up into it, just Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Thank you, God, for this day. Thank you for the blessings of this house, this home, this bed to sleep in. And she'll just roll with it. And so we haven't built a tradition, like a set of orders and tradition to the process of our prayer. It's been kind of informal. The tradition itself has just been the fact that there is prayer present before we go to bed.
That's good. So you've got going to church, praying daily, and what's the third one that you feel like it's been a positive impact on your family?
Third one would probably have to be dedicating time over material. So one of the things I remember growing up was, you know, a major league salary is a pretty big thing. And so I remember living in a nice house, you know, covered in bookshelves. We had good things, but those things aren't what I remember most from my time growing up. What I remember most is the time we spent as a family. I remember our family trip going to the Smoky Mountains. I remember spending time with Dad at the ballpark. I remember Mom having these little mystery games that she created on the fly for me and my older sibling as we were just kind of, you know, waiting around for Dad to finish up with his game. I remember going to different museums, like the Louisville Slugger Museum, the Muhammad Ali Museum, the art museums, all this stuff. I remember going to different national parks. The time I spent with my family is what I remember the most. And I wanted to take that into my own family with my wife and kids. And so, you know, we have everything we need. Our children, you know, if you go into their room, they have a couple toys here and there. They've got their favorite books. They've got material things that make their space their own. But my wife and I didn't want to emphasize stuff, just stuff in the house. And there's practical reasons for that. You know, if you got a bunch of stuff, it's kind of harder to keep a clean house. And, you know, but also, we make sure that they're very quick to be okay turning over stuff. So at least once a month, they're going through their clothes, they're going through their toys. What do I not use anymore that some other kid and some other family can benefit from? We'll bring it over to Goodwill. During Christmas, we don't, you know, fill this entire room with presents. We're okay with having, you know, a few gifts for our kids for Christmas. We don't go overboard on that. What we do insist on is actually going on trips and enjoying experiences with our kids. We'll go to the park, we'll take them hunting, we'll go to the beach, we'll go to museums as a family. We go on just walks with the dog, and we'll go through walks to the neighborhood, take them to the pool. Those are a lot more valuable to us. We put a much higher premium on the time we spend together. We have a bunch of board games where we'll sit down and play Settlers of Catan, or Risk or Monopoly, or my youngest son Nolan, he loves the game Apples to Apples. He's trying to learn that, and so we're learning that game. And we play puzzles together. We draw. We color. We play pretend. The boys love to play fight game with dad, where they're just trying to, you know, beat me up, and I'm just wrestling them the whole time. They love playing Batman and Joker, going outside, and the kids love when I get, you know, a bucket full of tennis balls, and I'm just throwing batting practice to them in the front yard, all of them, up and down the age lineup. Those are the things that we prioritize as a family, the actual time we spend together. I want my children to grow up, and I want them to think, my mom and dad wanted to spend time with us. They actively wanted to be a part of our lives and wanted us to go with them. So another small thing that I think is important is to take your kids with you. Regardless of what errands you have to run or what things you have to do. Obviously, when you have young kids, it's easier just to go to the grocery store yourself and get what you need. Get it, load it up, get out. But it might slow you down to have four kids with you, and they're each wanting to pick out their own items, and you might have to break up a little squabble or two, or they want to ride on the side of the cart, so it's about to turn over, so you got to muscle it the other way. There might be all these complications that come with having the kids at the store with you. Take them with you. They're going to remember that my dad pointed at me and said, come with me. I want you to be with me. My dad always wanted me with him in the truck. Whether we were going hunting or something big like that, or whether he was just going to the store to pick up a can of Folgers coffee because they were out, or going to, you know, the gun shop because he's going to pick up this case of ammunition he ordered, or whether we were going to pick up a bucket of baseballs. It didn't matter where he was going. He wanted a kid with him in the car at all times. And from what I heard when I spoke to my grandmother, my grandfather was the same way. He refused to get in the car and go anywhere unless he had at least one of his sons with him in the truck. Mm-hmm. So I didn't always start that way as a parent. At first I was always efficiency minded the first, 5 years of having kids. If I wanted to go to the store, I'll go alone. I'll get what I need, get it, get out of there. It's faster. But I began to realize the timeless value of, my kids want to be with me, and when they grow up, I want them to realize that I wanted them there with me. That part was just as important as getting the goods we needed for our house. And so, I really don't go anywhere without at least one of the kids coming with. And luckily, I don't even have to ask. Usually, if I get the keys and start putting on my shoes, my daughter will look up, hey, where are you going? I got to go to the store. Your mom needs more coffee. We need more milk. Can I come with? Yeah. Let me take a poll. Who else wants to come? And then, maybe Mickey says, no, I want to stay and read. And then Lincoln goes, I don't like going to the grocery store. That's fine. Nolan goes, I want to go. So I got two of them. So then I'll take them with me. And spending time together, knowing that the time you spend together is way more important than the dollar sign of how much you put down on your kids during Christmas time, or hey, we booked a whole weekend at the Great Wolf Lodge. That's great, but were you actually spending time together?
Was that part of your calculus in switching careers?
Yes. With sales, I was gone a lot. For the most part, I was able to be home at the end of the day, but when I was home, I could be on call. There could be something that went wrong, a sale that fell through, or maybe something in operations that as the sales rep, I have to go in and at least explain to the customer. So I was constantly in a state of, oh, I'm reading a bedtime story to the kids. My phone's ringing, so I'd have to walk out of the room and handle that. Experiences like that were just frustrating to my wife, frustrating to my kids, and detrimental to everyone.
I suppose in those would be instances where your kids might say, Dad, I want to come with you. And you're like,
yeah,
sorry, man.
Sorry, man. I can't, I can't have a 6-year-old explain to the customer why the ship went wrong. So, but when I switched over to being a teacher, not only was I in rhythm with their schedule as well, but working at that particular school, I'd see them in the hallways. So, or in some cases, I'd actually be teaching them. So they'd be in my class. Usually it was for gym class. And so I'd see them, give them a big old hug. All right, let's go run your laps. That additional time with the kids was just a light switch in their lives. They loved it. They loved it that I can be home with them all summer, just like they were, that all my breaks lined up with theirs, that I was seeing them in the hallways. That was just, they were filled with so much more joy and energy, not just from being in that school, because we had transferred them over from public school. Being in a faith-filled school lit them up with a new kind of energy, but also spending so much more time with their dad changed their life, I think.
Man, that's special.
Yeah.
You sound like a great dad.
Well,
you're on the right track.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I want you to get a chance to tell us a little bit about your book. Before you do that, I want to hear what your favorite piece of art is and why.
My favorite piece of art. Oh gosh. There's a work, oil painting by Caravaggio. I want to say I'm pronouncing his name right. Caravaggio. And it's The Calling of St. Matthew. And it's this kind of dark room, and there's an open window kind of shining a light. And you see this table full of men, and they're all kind of looking around, bewildered at this new arrival in the room. And you see, kind of almost hidden in shadow, Jesus Christ pointing his finger. And you even see one of the guys at the table kind of like, wait, me? Are you calling me? And you can't really tell who he's calling, but you know whoever he's pointing to, which is kind of ill-defined, that's St. Matthew. And in this painting, there's a lot of symbolism. The fact that when you see light pouring in, you assume it's from a window, but then you realize there's only one open window in the room, and that's not where the light's coming from. Mm-hmm. And you see Christ pointing, a group of men kind of concerned with their own business, and they're in shadow. And what I took from that painting when I looked at it was, Christ is calling St. Matthew in the painting. It's what it's called, but he's also calling each and every one of us, which is one of the reasons why I believe Caravaggio left it kind of ambiguous, specifically who he was pointing to. Each of the men are doing different things. One of them's kind of you could tell he was kind of engrossed in a conversation with another. One of them's going through paperwork. One of them's, counting coins up. No matter what we're doing, God is calling us to stop it. Yeah, that's the one right there. Holy cow. Yep. So you could see they're all kind of doing different things. They're all about their business. You can make whatever predictions you want on who he's pointing to. But in the end, if you really take the meaning of Caravaggio's painting to heart, he's pointing to you. Mm. He's pointing to you to stop whatever it is you're doing that's getting in the way between you and him, and to follow him the same way Matthew was called. Mm. And just like Matthew, we're called to immediately stop it and to follow in his footsteps, to trust in him no matter what, no matter how scary it can be, no matter what our previous frame of mind was or what our previous priorities are. They don't mean anything. It's all about Jesus Christ. Mm. Follow him, trust in his word, and everything else will fall into place according to his design.
Mm. That's fantastic. You know, I was just yesterday, I was looking at since it's St. Patrick's Day this week.
Yeah.
I was just reading a little bit about St. Patrick. Mm-hmm. And I came across the prayer that's still recited by a lot of people. And it's something like, I don't remember the whole thing, but it's something like, Christ be with me, Christ behind me, Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ to my left, to my right, to my front, to my back. And this idea that one of the things he's known for is saying, if anybody remembers me, let them remember Christ.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. That kind of reminds me of the words of who was it? Saint Paul, who said, "It is not I who live, but Christ who lives in me." The fact that there is no me anymore, other than what God wants me to be. But I completely hollow myself out of any preconceived notions of who I think I am, and completely open it up to who God wants me to be. And that's, there's this beautiful line from the show The Chosen. I don't know if you've seen it, where
Matthew,
I'm sorry?
I've seen parts of it.
Yeah. It's a great show, wonderfully made. Jonathan Rumi's a terrific actor, but the character of Matthew, he's talking to another one of the disciples, and he's like, I realized that I used to be filled with all this anxiety, all this worry. And then I realized at the beginning of each day, I really only have to do one thing. And the other disciples ask, what? He goes, just follow him. That's it. It takes all the weight, all the stress in the torment you might be going through due to your life situation. It takes all that and just pushes it aside almost casually. All I have to do is just follow him, open my heart and ask God, what do you want me to do here? What are the next steps you want me to take? That brings so much more peace to know that someone else, someone a lot better, has their hand on the wheel.
That's great. Great word. All right. Tell me a little bit about your book, Before You Go, Life Advice for the Rising Generation. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Why'd you write it? Give me a little synopsis.
So while I was teaching in those first years, I realized that, yes, it's important for us to teach the curriculum, but also we're teaching them about their faith. And they always had so many questions about how the faith applies to their life. And, you know, I didn't realize how much I enjoyed that process of teaching them about their faith, teaching them about these life skills. And at the end of every year, I would always write each of the students a handwritten letter about, you know, their time as a student, my hopes and prayers for them as they continue on in their high school career. I'd sign it and say, here, read it with your parents. You know, just know that wherever you go in life, here's a little piece of, you know, wisdom from your teacher that you can take with you everywhere you go. That continued on for years, and it meant a lot to a lot of the students. And on a side note, I didn't realize how sad I would be watching kids leave and go off to high school until that first year. So I used to think before I became a teacher that teaching was the hardest thing, like being a disciplinarian or doing this, doing that. I used to think of all these things that can make teaching hard. The hardest part is actually saying goodbye at the end of the year when they go off and you realize they're taking on the world. They're going off into you know, a world that can be very hostile to our faith. And that part brought me a lot of sadness. And it also brought me a sense of worry. Like, I wish I can tell them more. I wish that no matter where they went, I could always be there for them to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that actually grew when I thought in terms of my own children. Like, I'm here with them every day for, you know, 18 years. And then one day they're going to leave this house. And, you know, I might be a phone call away or maybe not. You never know when, you know, God's going to call you home. And so I wanted something lasting, something that was there, something permanent that they can hold in their hands that were, you know, just common sense, faith-based advice. That could be anything from mental frameworks, how to see the world in a productive way that makes you see the best in other people and not the worst, to see the potential in yourself, to not always be so down on yourself or to have a defeatist attitude, to know that you do have power to make changes in your life. You have the power to see people, no matter what happened in that relationship, as another human being that's also loved and cherished by God. Even little daily habits, just from my time teaching middle school students, you see the little quirks about them that make you laugh. Just you can tell they've just formed bad habits, whether that's procrastination or choosing to not shower and just use deodorant as your form of shower. Just little funny things like that that make you laugh about middle school students, or styling their hair like it's crazy, like you just went after it with a weed eater. You know, like, no, put a comb through your hair. You have no idea how many small conversations that I have to have with a student, like during mass day, they'd show up and their tie would look sloppy. I'm like, no, this isn't about looking good for this particular day. It's about presenting yourself as a professional, no matter where you go. You never know who's watching. You know, you want to make yourself look presentable. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just little life lessons like that, as if there's a mentor always with them. So I don't know what caused me to do it, but around year, probably the end of year two or the beginning of year three, I started putting a list together of all these things that I was thinking of that I wanted them to take with them, including my own children. And I put it together in a book format, and I shopped it around a little bit to see if an agent was willing to look at it. I mean, who knows? If it ended up with a publisher, fantastic. But I didn't have many high hopes, and you know, nothing really panned out there. So I was like, you know what? I'll put it out anyway. I'll put it on Amazon. And what's funny is when it came out, I had a lot of former students, you know, reach out. Oh, you wrote a book. That's amazing. I want to go get it. I was like, well, thank you. You know, I appreciate it. There was one part of the book that when I originally published it, it was under a different name called Dear Graduate. And I had taken that whole section of the book and not put it in. And it was a book, about 30 to 40 pages on dating. Mm. And I was like, well, I don't know anything about dating anyway. I married my high school sweetheart. I've been married for 12 years. Like, I really don't know anything about the dating scene today. And so I put the book out, and it sold for a while. Then the more I thought about it, the more I realized, well, I might not know that much about what's going on in the dating scene today, but I do know some timeless things, some things that about how men and women relate to each other that are bigger than just this current era, that have lasted. The things you see marriages last 50, 60, 70 years on. And so I realized that it was a mistake to take it out. So I put it in, gave it the name Before You Go. I thought it was a better sounding name, and then released it. And so I wrote it in the way that I would talk to my students whenever they'd ask, you know, a question. Like, I remember a student asked me, like, do I need a shower? Like, I told her, like, man, you just got out of PE. You smell, boy. She goes, yeah, I don't need a shower. Do I? I'm just going to get dirty again. I was like, I just stopped. I said, shower. Don't be gross. And that was it. And that was a funny one. I thought I'd put that in literally just so I can make that student laugh if he ever reads it. But it's just little things like that. I wanted to express the values I hold in my heart, you know, timeless ones about your mental frameworks on life, daily habits that are helpful to your success, and then just how to date for young men, how to be a gentleman, how to take on your role seriously as a provider and a protector, to realize I'm not just dating for some temporary fun. I'm dating with intention. I'm going to treat this young lady like a young lady, and I'm going to have this purpose of, do our values match up? I'm not in this for one small thing. I'm in this to potentially look for, you know, the criteria for a partner for the rest of my life. So I want to see who God is calling me to be with.
No, that's fantastic. Yeah. That's awesome. I had a friend of mine who told me when he was growing up, he was in a room with other guys who were interested in becoming pastors, and the guy who was leading this group asked them, I think it was 20 guys, and the leader of the group asked, how many of your dads talked to you about sex when you're growing up? And two people raised their hand. And I think it's two, that's right, out of this whole group. And, you know, it's an amazing thing that we think that if we've grown up with a family who is maybe more intentional, and I'm probably in that number, but I don't think my dad. Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think he ever talked to me about sex. Maybe like vaguely one time in the car we were driving, and he may have given me a comment. Yeah. No, but no yeah. real like intentionality or like framework, as you mentioned. You know, and I think right. there's probably a surprising number of high school, middle school, and high school students who no one's ever really talked to them directly about. What does dating look like? All they've seen is what's in the movies, TV shows, or what their friends are doing. And there's no real framework to go, what's the point of all this? And I think that's fantastic that you put that back in there.
Yeah. And I knew that including a dating section, I would have to kind of tread carefully, because the last thing I wanted to do as a you know, mentor, as a coach, as the teacher for some of the people that might actually be buying this, is I didn't want to ruin anyone's innocence.
Yeah.
So I address certain topics carefully and let them know that let's stay goal oriented. And the goal is to find someone to marry. Yeah. And I know at one point in the book, I say to date successfully means to end up in a long, healthy, happy marriage. Not to date a lot of people. Dating a lot of people doesn't mean you dated successfully. That means you failed at a lot of relationships. I mean, which is okay. If it takes you a lot of tries to find out, like, okay, some people's path is going to be quicker than others. I married my high school sweetheart. Some people, they date a lot of people. They're trying to find that one. They're goal-oriented, but it just doesn't, they just can't find the right situation. I understand that. But yeah, I came from the same situation. That wasn't a topic that, you know, me and my dad really, really broached when I was growing up. And so, yeah, there was a lot of you know, mystery there. And I think it blows my mind that parents, especially fathers, are okay with a complete stranger teaching your kid this in some sort of a cold, calculated classroom curriculum, but not their father, who knows them, who was there the day they were born, who's been with them and sat across from them at the breakfast table every single day. If there's anyone to talk about such an intimate subject, it should be their father and mother. That only makes sense. Why would you just be okay with some random person? You might as well just grab a person off the street. Hey, you, come talk to my kid. Like, it just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense. I agree with you. Yeah, I remember when my dad died, I remember once we had learned that he was sick, I sat down with him and I asked him, you know, about pornography and about if he had struggled with that growing up and all those kinds of things. And I asked him, you know, why didn't you talk to me about those things? And he just said, I didn't think about it. Like it didn't come to mind as a thing. I'm assuming his dad didn't do that for him. And
yeah.
So that, again, back to that frame of reference, that just wasn't in his frame of reference as something to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of us land in that position.
Well, it's becoming more prevalent now because it's harder for fathers to have a framework of today based on them growing up, because that whole world of just sex, pornography, all that, that's changed by leaps and bounds. It's no longer just, you know, something physical in like a red light district or a magazine. Now it's in the palm of anyone's hand if they have a smartphone. You have a smartphone, you've got a gateway to this torrent, this fire hydrant of trash, of filth.
Yeah.
And so it's important for fathers to really take the initiative of, it doesn't matter what rubric I was growing up with. Mm-hmm. It's a whole new ball game. I need to address this.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. No, I'm with you. I'm 100% with you on that. Awesome. Hey, well, Michael, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I was very encouraged by our whole conversation. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Fellow fathers and friends, So glad you could join us for this episode. To stay connected, visit our website at fatherandfriend.com. Sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media sites. Be sure to like, follow, and share with fellow dads and families in your community. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, send us a message and let us know. Until our next episode, keep showing up, loving deeply, and making an impact for the good of your family. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Father and Friend.